history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that need to be told, and we're always better off when we take the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And there's no mistake about it. I am sitting in the home of one of the few, the proud, the U.S. Marines of World War II. And I guess the first indication was the big Marine Corps flag flying underneath the Stars and Stripes in his front yard. Or maybe it was his belt buckle or his bolo tie or all the little bulldogs in his Eagle room, the Marine Corps rug, the Marine Corps sword, Marine Corps everything around here. Carl Appel of Los Osos, California. And Carl, I just can't get over the view you have in your home here. I'm looking out one way, and there's the familiar view of Morro Rock with the Morro Strand stretching down south along the California coastline, Hollister Peak in the other direction. I bet you never get sick of looking out your windows.
No, I certainly don't. And it was one of the best moves we ever made in our lives when we settled here in Los Osos. We just love it and never regretted the move.
And something else just hit me. I bet that there's probably nowhere else in America you can go to see something that looks as much like Mount Suribachi as Morro Rock right over there.
Yes, every time I look out there, it's a reminder. It's a little shorter than Suribachi, but it certainly resembles it.
Well, and when you go to Morro Rock, nobody's shooting at you, so that's a plus. And Carl was on Iwo Jima, and that famous scene that you've all seen reminds him and so many of you of that island that so many Marines fought and died for. And Carl was one of those who fought and got wounded but came home, and we're going to hear that story. But let's go back to the early years. You're growing up in Brentwood, Pennsylvania, outside of Pittsburgh with a sister during the Great Depression. What were those years like? Because I'm imagining people my age probably have a hard time really grasping what life was like back then.
Well, fortunately, my dad was employed during the Depression, and of course there's many things we had to do without, nothing special at all, but we did have to watch it pretty close as to our activities, and of course it was quite limited.
So what do you remember about those childhood years? Did you have some memorable activities? Did you have some hopes and dreams of what you might do someday?
Well, I think the thing that stays with me the most is that one day, of course, we were living in an apartment, and there was a salesman that came to the door that had children's books. And my mother signed up for these books. And that evening, she was reading one of the stories to me, and it was about the little train that I think I can, trying to get up the grade. And then he made it, and I knew I could or knew we could or something to that effect. And, oh, boy, I really loved that story and was looking forward to more of them. Well, when my dad came home, he, of course, wondered where this book came from. And mother said, well, I signed up to buy these. And he said, we can't afford them. So they had to be turned back in. And that was one of the biggest disappointments during that period of time for me.
And how old were you when you started skiing?
Well, I was in high school. A bunch of guys that I hung around with went skiing at some of our ski resorts that were in the mountains around Pennsylvania there. And I would say that I was probably, 14, 15 years old. We would go for the weekends. We'd go drive all this way up on a Saturday, come back, and then drive all the way back up on a Sunday to keep skiing. So I really enjoyed that.
So much so that it motivated you when it was time to get into the service, as we're going to hear about. And I'm sure a lot of people associate skiing with the Marine Corps. But But I want to ask you about something else that it seems like everybody your age remembers and has a specific memory of. December 7th, 1941. Do you remember how that news of what happened way out on Oahu came to you?
Well, a good friend of our family and myself were actually deer hunting in the mountains around Pittsburgh there. Coming back on Sunday on the car radio, we heard about the Japanese attacking Pearl Harbor, which of course was a real shock to us. That's how I became aware of the outbreak of the war.
And you're there in the car, you have some time to talk about it with those other folks. Did it occur to you at all that that was something you might personally end up involved with?
Not at the time. That, of course, I had a rude awakening not too long after that when the draft came up and picked me up.
So when that happened, you've got to figure out what you want to do in the service. And can you avoid getting sent where they want to send you? And that whole skiing thing gave you a little idea?
Well, I had wanted to get into the mountain infantry because that, of course, included skiing, which I really loved. And so it was handled through the National Ski Association. I got all the papers necessary to get in the mountain infantry. And all I had to do was, when I was drafted, was to get into the Army. And then I would be sent directly to Camp Hale, Colorado, for mountain infantry training. So after my physical, I was given some papers and said, go sit down and wait till this young man at the table calls you. And so I waited, and pretty soon I was called up to the table, and the young man said, Navy or Marine Corps. And what a shock that was to me, because here I have all the papers filled out to go to Camp Hale, Colorado for mountain infantry training. And so I explained all this to the young man at the table, and he listened very patiently. After I got through, he said, what do you want, Navy or Marine Corps? Wow. Well, I've used my astute brain and figured out, well, I know darn well that the Navy doesn't have any mountain infantry or skiing. So I thought, the Marine Corps, that's the one where to go. And so I said, Marine Corps. The stamp fell on my papers, and a young man told me to go down to the recruiting sergeant for the Marine Corps and get your papers filled out. So I went down. The recruiter said, well, I have a chair right by this typewriter, and I'll sit here and I'll ask you questions, then I'll type your form for you. And one of the questions that he asked was, why did you volunteer for the Marine Corps? And of course, I went through the spiel about mountain infantry and so forth, and he just about fell off the chair laughing. He said, son, he says, the only thing you're going to be skiing on is sand. And how true that was.
I haven't seen any of those photos of Marines skiing on sand in the Pacific. So then you're a Marine. At least they were going to turn you into a Marine. And we've all seen the caricatures and the stereotypes of Marine Corps drill instructors. What was that really like, that training to become a Marine?
Well, at the time I went in, which was in 1943, the Marine Corps, and of course I went to boot camp at Parris Island, and at that time the drill instructor could do anything he wanted to really with you. He could slap you around or cuss you, or it's anything he could think of he could do to you. There was a episode sometime later, and I think it did happen at Parris Island, where this drill instructor was running his troops through a swamp, and several of the Marine recruits drowned. And as a result of that occurrence, they really clamped down on what drill instructors could do. They couldn't put their hands on you. They couldn't use profanity when they talked to you. They're pretty limited as to what they could do. Not that that has had any effect really on the quality of the Marines they produced. They're still getting the same type of person that they want, but without all the hard stuff that they used to do.
What was the hardest thing for you to deal with?
It was digging French drains, which it requires pits to be dug and then gravel put in them. And that was one of the toughest things. And of course, the drilling, which was quite extensive. Of course, as I mentioned too, the Marine recruiters could do just about anything they wanted. They could fly you out in the middle of the night if they so desired and march you and so forth. So, but I think one of the biggest things was those French drains. Because in Paris Island, it was pretty darn hot.
So you were probably excited to come out to the West Coast and get ready to go overseas. But I understand there was some business you had to take care of before that. And I guess I need to ask you about your late wife, Flo, because you two were married for 71 years. But it goes back further than that, that you were high school sweethearts?
Yes, yes, we were. In fact, I first saw Flo in the cafeteria, and I was with my buddy, and I said, "Who is that nice-looking young lady over there?" And he happened to be in her class at school, so he introduced me to Flo. And at first, she didn't want a thing to do with me. She thought I was a spoiled brat. But I guess I wore her down enough that she finally accepted me.
So you're getting ready to go overseas, and I don't know how you felt about it, but there's no guarantee you're going to come back, right?
That's correct. I actually became engaged by proxy, and by that I mean I had purchased the engagement ring for Flo from a jeweler in Pittsburgh that my dad had known. And so he had the ring there in Pittsburgh, and my intention was the next Liberty that I was going to propose to Flo. However, that didn't come along the way I wanted to. I ended up in Camp Pendleton, ready to ship overseas, and I still wanted to be engaged, so it ended up that my sister and mother and dad went over to Flo's home, and my sister proposed to Flo. And that's where I got proposal by proxy, or engaged by proxy. And the next day at Camp Pendleton, I got a telegraph saying, "I accept." And that was it.
I've heard a lot of stories, but I don't think I've ever heard the proposal by your sister and the response via telegram. That is pretty unique.
Well, Flo worked for Western Union, so she had access to a telegram very easily.
Well, at least that telegram said she said yes. It would have been a rough way to hear no. But now you're going to be going overseas. What did you really expect? Do you remember what that teenager was thinking about what the future might hold?
Well, as we sailed out of San Diego, I looked back at the shore and was wondering if I was ever going to get back there. Going into the unknown, combat and so forth, you just don't know what to expect, really. And I ended up, after we stopped at Pearl Harbor on the way over, and I ended up on Guam, where I joined the 3rd Marine Division, 9th Regiment. And we trained there. Of course, we didn't know at the time where we were going, but we were training for Iwo Jima.
Had you ever heard of Iwo Jima before?
Never. I didn't. It was new to just about everyone. We didn't know where it was or anything about it. But, of course, it was in the Japanese sphere of influence pretty close. And I know there's been questions about how necessary was it for us to take all that loss for that little island. But when you think about the number of aircraft, B-29s and other bombers that would have been lost if we hadn't taken Iwo and had airfields there. Plus, Iwo provided air support, fighter support for the bombers that went over Japan. Like I say, on the trip back, they, of course, had sustained quite a bit of damage, a lot of them, in going over Japan, and they would have had to ditch, but rather than try to get all the way to Saipan, Tinian, and Guam. So as a result of us taking Iwo, we saved, I forget how many, crewmen and aircraft, of course, with the fighter escort. I don't know how many bombers we saved by having the escorts for them.
So those who speculate as to whether the cost and all the Marines who gave their lives there was worth it, you're really part of that cost because you were wounded on Iwo Jima, and you're saying, yeah, it absolutely was worth it.
Yes, and like I say, there's people that just don't agree with that, but if they look at all the statistics, they'll certainly see that it was worth it. Our sacrifice to take Iwo.
And we're hearing from a guy who has thought of Iwo Jima so often over the 73 years since he was wounded there as a 19-year-old. Carl Appel of Los Osos, California is our guest today. You'll find photos and a short video of Carl at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll come right back after this.